When we last left our heroes, they were locked into a terribly important discussion. Let's drop in on them again as they plot the future. Now, from the Top Dog's Kennel in beautiful downtown Burbank, it's the Terrence and Philip Show.
Thank you, Gary, and welcome to another episode of the Terrence and Philip Show. I'm Philip Hodgetts.
And I'm Terrence Curran.
And in this episode, we are going to have another go at what would happen if there were no established television production industry and we started over. What would that look like? And I know we talked about this once before with Howard, but I think that there's been some interest for us to take the ideas a little bit further and talk about it. And we should probably tell the audience that we had another go at this in between. And I found myself arguing against Terry.
Imagine that.
Well, and until I thought about it further and realized that I shouldn't have been, because I inherently agreed largely with one of the main points that was made. So,
well, now what the heck are we going to talk about?
Well, we're going to talk about it so that other people can hear what we said.
Oh, okay.
And I will try not to disagree with you this time when I agree with you.
Well, I don't even remember what I said that you agreed with or didn't agree with. Okay. So where do you want to start?
Well, it's important when we're starting to think about greenfield. And greenfield means that we haven't got any established workflows. We don't have any established publicity promotion. We don't have any established distribution.
Just a greenfield.
Just a greenfield, a bare empty building or whatever that we can outfit however we like.
Where we hope that if you build it, they will come.
If they build it, they will come. Indeed. So I was curious. I mean, I started writing about this on my blog in November 2009, so it's been exercising my mind a long time as to what would happen if we started over and how would that differ? The point where we diverged in the previous reading was that you were pretty much coming to the conclusion that there needed to be some sort of studio.
Mm-hmm.
And I was arguing more on a single producer level, but I think if I look back at even what I wrote, I really was talking about an alternate way of doing a studio.
Mm-hmm.
Because the studio brings two things, and I'd almost want to find another word for it than studio, because there's an enormous amount of baggage.
Yeah, yeah. It's the best description we have.
It's the best description we have, as bad as it is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are a lot of things that we could do to standardize. You know, in the simpler side of it, you know, on the workflow side, we could standardize. If we had a studio that was a way of financing,
mm-hmm.
a way of determining what the audience are, and these
right.
are things that we probably need to talk about separately.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that? How do you build that audience if you don't have channel right. building and billboards and all of that? And how would we more efficiently produce?
I mean, there's three different areas. There's
yeah.
creating the content,
yeah.
and there's distributing the content, and then there's finding the audience.
Yes, exactly,
so,
yeah.
Well, actually, there's a fourth part, which is hopefully making money off of it.
That would be the point of a business of entertainment,
yes.
and that's
yeah.
that is something I think we frequently forget, or people frequently forget, is that we are in the business of
that's right.
entertainment. We're not in the hobby of entertainment. That would be called independent filmmaking.
Exactly.
Oh, ooh, yeah.
Now you've done it.
I've now alienated our independent filmmaking audience. But when you look at the reality about independent films, 2,000
yes.
of them get made every year, 20 get shown at Sundance, 10 of them get picked up, or whatever that number sequence is.
Yeah, it's one makes money, right?
You are better off to take your budget and go to Las Vegas and gamble. You've got a higher chance of getting a return than you have making an independent film.
That's true.
That's with the good news out of Sundance this year, which was that more films than the previous years got picked up. There was some serious good news out of Sundance this year compared with the previous 2 years. But that still doesn't make a new industry, and that's where the simplest part of it, I think, is standardizing the production, working out of locations as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
We look at the production techniques that are done on Sanctuary and Warehouse 13 and even Boardwalk. Is it Boardwalk Boulevard? The one that's set in Atlantic City? Boardwalk Dreams.
Yeah. Is it just Boardwalk? I don't know. I know the one you're talking
yeah.
about.
Yeah. Well, they built a set. It's something like 300 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
But it's essentially the sand and then a blue screen, the end of the boardwalk and a blue screen and a building and a blue screen continuing the building out.
Mm-hmm.
All of the above this one facade row is CGI. Everything beyond the beach, the ocean, the sky, every sky shot is completely fake. They employ somebody just to do skies, sky stylers.
Wow.
So,
and they're probably in India.
A lot of the yeah. Well, see, that's something else we could talk about. Yeah. Is that less of the VFX industry to India and the like. But maybe we won't talk about that in this show.
So back to the greenfield. Okay.
Yeah, the greenfield. I think a lot of greenfield is going to be green screen. And I know there was a period in our history where green screen was A, incredibly complex, and B, not terribly convincing.
Right.
I've seen material that I found out later was green screen, and it never even entered my mind that a shot spin around in Times Square would be a green screen shot. That why wouldn't you just go to Times Square and shoot it? Well, because to do a spin around of one guy in a studio where he can be on a turntable with green screen all around him,
right?
And then just do a setting somebody out with a Steadicam into Times Square to do one rotation, it's going to be a whole lot less expensive than taking a crew to Times Square, setting it up, stopping traffic, getting all the permissions, everything that goes with an outdoor shoot, the honey carts, the food, everything that goes with that, compared with the studio where it's green screen and there's a commissary adjacent in the same building or a food truck turns up. Or
right, but you still, it's tricky to get everything right. And the more people you have involved, the more intricate it gets, having everybody reacting properly with an environment that's not there,
but if you look at the reels from Stargate Studios over in Glendale there and other people, that what they've done on shows, that it's obviously getting to the point where the sorts of considerations are now at least manageable if the workflow is manageable. And remember, one of the advantages we've got in having a new studio is that we're mandating what the workflow is. We're mandating one format. We're mandating one workflow that we know works. None of this stuff that you particularly have to deal with all the time, which is every workflow has been different because everybody made their own rules up as they went along. So we won't have that. We'll have the ability to manage metadata, to use metadata to automate as much of the workflow as it can be. Because if we want to reduce cost, the one cost we've got to reduce the most of is the people cost.
Well, you kind of have that with Avatar. I mean, it was, you know, a pre-mocked up world and everything was shot green screen. You know? And he actually, you know, Cameron had his little, you know, camera that he could actually see when they did a performance actually over the mocked up world in real time. I mean, it's one of the things you really need to be able to do it well is to see it actually comped together. Because otherwise, you're just shooting over a green screen. You need talented actors and you need a really talented director who can visualize what's actually going on back there for the whole thing and piece all that together in his mind on top of everything else that's going on. So, you know, I don't think it's as easy as you're saying. You know, it's one thing to say, you know, we did these five establishing shots that way. It's another thing to say we did a 2-hour movie that way.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking perhaps more television, where you're churning it out, because that's where we've seen this already being adopted. Heroes has had a lot of stuff that was green screen that I, watching the show, had never even contemplated was. I haven't watched a lot of it, but the series Sanctuary started as a web series. So they really know how to keep production costs to a minimum because they never had money.
Right.
So they clearly have worked out that the technique, so that they can do about 70% of the show Sanctuary is a few set pieces and green screen.
Okay.
Everything else is green screen. Unless they're going to use a set repeatedly, they don't build more than a couple of props.
Well, yeah, it makes sense for, you know, replacing a giant set. But for shooting on a location that's already here.
Yeah, you probably have a combination of set pieces and green screen in your studio. And a lot of stuff is, even in that Stargate Studios showreel, is where they've got out of the studio, but they've done it in a green screen. They've just lent something up against the building of the studio, put a green screen behind it, and now it's a New York street, but it's on the Warner Brothers lot.
Now I get the track you're going down, because I wasn't thinking in terms of what you're talking about is you're thinking of the studio, the physical sets that are built and whatnot of a studio. I'm talking about studio. I'm talking more about the business model of production and all that.
But in order to make this really work as a sort of new business model,
right?
You have a studio that is set up to do the types of shows you want to do. If that's westerns, then you would set up an optimal workflow probably on a ranch somewhere,
right?
Where you had some outdoor sets, because it's you're not going to do that much western stuff on a green screen. Certainly concede that.
Right.
Now, you need to extend a nominal warehouse of weird and strange things that goes out for 300 or 400 feet into the distance that you're going to slide down on a wire. Well, that's easier done on green screen than it is in building that set. And we see a lot, even in movies, we see a lot of set extension work being done on blue screen in that case. But
Well, that's been going on forever, though.
Yeah, but it's increasing. It's become increasingly real. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, they're getting better. Yeah. But again, it's still not simple to do. I mean, there's a website somebody sent me last week. This place in Florida, it's Media Mobs, MediaMobz.com, and they whip out a commercial for you really cheaply. And basically, you give them your script and maybe your logo or whatever, and they use their stand-up talent. And it's, you know, this elaborate shot with a camera coming down on a dolly and comes up right up to the talent who's talking about your product, X product. And in the background on all these screens, your product is, you know, sailing by as they talk about yours. And they do these commercials for like $150 or something, which means they're just cranking them out. Everything's got to be a green screen. And then if you start looking at them really carefully, then you start noticing like the foot of the talent isn't perfectly tracking with the floor, and there's not really a shadow next to them on the floor, yeah. And things like that. And you go, oh, okay. I mean, you know, most people aren't going to see that, but if you really look at it and analyze it, you can see it's not done well. In effect shots, people are looking for it.
Yeah.
So you won't get away with it as well, and that's part of the problem.
That's true, and the shadows are a dead giveaway.
Yeah.
I guess my point is that we're heading into a direction where green screen is frequently the less expensive option, whereas once upon a time it was the expensive option because you couldn't even do it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think we're seeing a trend where green screen is being used as part of the routine production because it is overall less expensive and less complex than going and taking a crew out of the physical space where you're working.
Yeah, I got to tell you, from the perspective of somebody in post, there are more ways to screw up green screens than there are to do it right.
Yeah.
And I've dealt with it all.
But again, we're talking about a controlled environment. So you only have one group of people working. You only have one workflow that's dictated. You don't have the sort of variability that exists.
You still see them screwing it up, you know. And then they'll go and shoot it on their iPhone and come in and go, here, can you key this over?
Well, like, we wouldn't. Yeah, well, we wouldn't be seeing that if we were trying to build a production business that was a production line business,
right.
Really. Well, rather than thinking of it as being the creative business, that there always needs to be a creative component to.
But okay, so let's get away from the real estate because
yeah.
The rest of it, I think, is more interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've got a green field. So we built a couple green screen stages on there so that for stuff that we need to shoot, you know, we can do a lot there. Otherwise, we're shooting on locations.
Largely, yeah.
Okay. So, you know, now comes you want to do this economically. One of the things that we lost quality-wise when we lost the studio system, which was, you know, a long time ago, one of the things we lost is that, you know, people worked at the studio all year round. You were, you know, constantly employed. If you were a director and you just finished an A film and they didn't have another one lined up for you, they stuck you on a B film or something.
Yeah.
You were working all the time. You know, if you're a DP, you're working all the time. Everybody was working all the time, which is why you got great movies like, you know, Casablanca, which was not, you know, a big movie, but they were all very talented people working on it, you know. That's one of the things that I'd love to see come back because now if you're a director, you maybe make a movie every 3 years.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I agree. I totally agree that I think having a repertory staff, I mean,
yeah.
Really almost back to that repertory theatre model of that used to be
yes.
common in the UK
yeah.
particularly
yeah.
where you would be doing a stage play every week.
Right.
Same group of people, same basic idea, same set pieces were just repurposed, you
right.
rehearsed, blocked it, staged it. While you were doing last week's play at night, you rehearsed, blocked and staged next week's play, and on Sunday it swapped over. On Monday night we opened with a new play.
Right.
Now, that's probably what television production is like, largely, and we just need to smooth that out as much as we can to keep the cost affordable.
So we'd still have, you know, now you've got the economy of you have to support a group of people. So
yes.
We've got that
that's
that
true.
Cost.
Yes.
Okay, so you want to have a stable of people, you've got that cost. You've got the real estate to build your stages on,
however,
so you've got that cost.
Yeah, I would argue that perhaps when you have people on staff salaries, you're probably not paying the premium that talent can command
so,
in a freelance world.
So to open
and that goes both ways.
To open a questionable subject, are you suggesting there wouldn't be unions driving for higher costs and benefits and whatnot?
My feeling about unions, and I've been on both sides of this, I've been in theatre unions in Australia and I've been in businesses that didn't have unions. Unions, I think, are an essential pushback against people being exploited.
Mm-hmm.
And if people are not being exploited and people are being treated fairly with benefits and a decent middle class salary, I mean, I'm talking, you know, 100, you know, somewhere depending on the skill level, depending on the job, but people might be in the you know, the 60K to 120K or the 40K to 120, 200K mm-hmm. area. There's, you know, fewer people making $2 million an episode and more people and 10 people making $200,000 is kind of my model.
Right.
Including if the union is the way to go, I'm not opposed to unions. I'm opposed to some of the stupid work practices that have come about because of unions claiming
yes.
jurisdictions. That would have to go.
Yeah.
And if that means that you have to create one new union for your facility, well, so be it. That's the way we go. But I'm not opposed to unions, and I think unions have been an important part of stopping workers generally in all industries being exploited stupidly. But they do lead to some excesses in the other direction as well, and I'd like to balance that out.
It's almost like they should come, do the job, and then be done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have a fair and equitable workplace, the push is not there to unionize.
Right.
And to my feeling, no workplace has ever been truly better off for unions.
No, yeah.
Individual workers, probably, but overall, I'm not sure that we are overall better off. I know that there were lots of things in the theatre industry union award that were just blatantly rip-offs towards the theatre owner or the theatre
yeah.
hirer. So,
right, right.
Which was nice for my pocket. I didn't mind it at all. But little anomalies like if you work past 11 o'clock on Saturday night packing up a show, your minimum pay is another 20 hours.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And we were a theatre where people came and went pretty much on a nightly basis. So if there was a show on Saturday night, we usually worked past 11.
Wow.
But one could always change one's hours so that they didn't hit that penalty if you felt kindly towards the show or how you were treated by your boss. And they made anyway.
We could go on with union. Yeah.
Yes. As I said, unions are have become a necessary evil because of the evil of the employer in many cases and the willingness. And I hope that if we're building this theoretical construct called a new studio, that we can find a fair and equitable workplace.
Yeah, I would. Yes, without a union, it would probably be easier to run it.
Yep.
You know, this is you're not talking about forcing people to go down in coal mines here.
No. These are fairly nice jobs, generally speaking.
Yes.
And if we have the fun or we have the ability to have premises properly built for editorial rather than temporarily thrown together for this show or that mm-hmm. show in four rooms at Raleigh Studios or whatever you happen to do, then you can have a nicer working environment for everybody, I think.
I agree.
So then we've only just got to fund it and get an audience for it. That's the simple part.
Well, so you've got your crew.
Yep.
Now you've got to come up with talent, and then it becomes the talent question. Do you want Tom Cruise? Well, that's going to be $20 million or whatever. But
well, the research has shown that despite what the industry believes, mm-hmm. that adding Tom Cruise or another name to your movie will pay off in the bottom line, it in fact does not. The solid research shows that having name stars doesn't by itself improve the saleability of a movie. Now, we've discussed this before, and mm-hmm. your counterpoint will be that it helps people who might be on the edge of whether they're going to go and see a movie or not.
Right, right.
To go to something because familiarity is.
Or if they're going to rent a movie and they pick something up at a Blockbuster and look at it, or they're looking at it online or whatever, and they don't recognize any names. On the other hand, if they see somebody they know, then it's a possibility. Another layer on top of this is if you want to sell in the foreign market right now, you better have a name. It could be a B name or a C name, but you better have a name or don't even bother because they don't want to hear about it.
That's certainly true for film.
Yeah.
It's less true for television.
Who watches TV?
I don't watch a lot of TV, but the current stat is at about 4.5 hours per day for the average American. And the UK, more hours per day. So a lot of people are watching television. I'm really thinking this is probably more a television model than a film model.
Right.
Because film does tend to be one-off productions.
Okay, so you're looking more at the episodic approach.
I'm looking more at the episodic approach. And in terms of deriving the demand, it's really produced to demand. There's a company called Demand Media, mm-hmm. which people may or may not have heard of. Demand Media probably represents the absolute worst direction this model could go in. They have built themselves an algorithm that looks at the Google Analytics, Google Trends searches, looks for what search terms people are searching. Mm-hmm. They then farm them out to low-cost production, both text and video. And we're talking about producing a 4 to 6 minute piece to formula for $50 or something in that nature.
It seems to me if they're looking for the highest returns, the highest returns off of Google searches, wouldn't they be making porno?
No, because
they just skip that.
They skip that, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they are... their accounting is somewhat questioned by people, but they account these over 5 years, amortize these over 5 years,
mm-hmm.
whereas they probably don't truly have a five-year life, and they probably should be counting them in the first year. But because of that, they look to be making more money than they are, and their IPO went very successfully.
Hmm.
So, but let's sort of step back from this horrible model,
mm-hmm.
but say that by using the very best of audience and analysis tools that we could possibly come up with, and nobody is using these tools at the moment.
Right.
Something along those lines. We know that there's a demand for this type of programming for this audience, that we're going to reach them through these types of media, we're going to get to them there, and then we're going to get them to consume either the programming through a subscription or through product, we'll fund it through product placement.
Okay, so here we go. Now we're getting, here we go, point, counterpoint. All right, here's my counterpoint to that. Everything that is the absolute worst about studios and networks, et cetera, that you'll hear from anybody is that they all try to make the shows for the audience they believe is there. And, you know, if one show does well, then you're going to have 24 versions of that show coming from everybody else. The cake makers, okay, now you got the cupcake makers, and you get the, you know, whatever happens to be successful, everybody else, well, that's what it is, we got to do that. And why wouldn't this be the same thing? You're going, well, this is what we need, so we try to make something for that, as opposed to, here's a show I want to make.
Again, you might as well go to Vegas.
Well,
take your $2 million to Vegas, because what percentage of pilots might get made into real shows?
The thing is, the shows that end up, you know, really being great and successful, as along with movies too, are not ones that are obviously made for a pre-made audience. They're made because somebody wanted to make that movie.
That's true.
You know?
That's high art. That's not what we're talking about.
Well, I am. What's the point in doing it otherwise?
You know? Well,
otherwise you're just doing news.
I think there's a middle ground. There's a place where you can establish what the demand is. I mean, we look at...
You're talking about the Fishing Channel or something like that.
No, I'm talking about more scripted content rather than reality. I don't see this studio producing reality in my model.
Right.
Because I'm not a big fan of reality.
So, mm-hmm.
Apart from Top Chef. All right, we watch Project Runway 2, but...
Well, see.
That's it for reality, and we like Top Chef better.
Better hope Mark Rodanis doesn't hear that.
Sorry, Mark. I nearly said sorry, Mark. But we like both shows. We watch them both. But knowing the taste,
mm-hmm.
if somebody could accurately predict my taste, such in using the algorithms that Netflix are now using to work out and predict what it is that I would want to watch, and remember they paid $1 million for a 10% improvement on their recommendation algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you have all of that and you go with the reverse and you say the demand is for programs that match these criteria, and somebody comes up with an idea that matches,
mm-hmm.
then produce it. Because if you know where your audience is coming from, and this is part of the building an audience for an independent project, is part of what I talk about in my presentation on the subject, which you'll be able to catch at NAB. as part of the post-production conference.
It's a good thing there was no plug there.
No plug at all. If you look at that, the way to grow an audience is to start from where the audience is now and slowly ingratiate yourself into their life and then start to promote your own. That's how they promote
right.
it.
The social marketing.
Marketing,
definitely.
which is a two-way street.
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly have seen a lot more social marketing around more modern programs that make really good connections with their audience.
Right.
And I think that's part of this future model, is that the shows really need to connect with their audience closely,
mm-hmm.
so that, A, they don't take the show into a strange direction.
Right.
There's a trend in subject on, I think, the second season of Friday Night Lights, where there was a murder committed by one of the protagonist characters. And it really was out of character for the show, and the audience response was not that good. You know, if we had a better social marketing, social aspect to production, where the producers were more in touch with, you know, even the top 2% of their audience, they could run ideas past the inner circle audience.
So what you're talking about is more like the traditional live theater. You know, actors always love live theater because they're getting immediate feedback from the audience as they're performing. And so their performance improves over the run of a show because they get more – and it varies from show to show depending on the audience, because some audiences are different, obviously.
Yes. Yeah.
And so a play won't be exactly the same from one night to the next – you know, as the audience changes.
The lighting guy occasionally forgets a cue.
Yeah. But my point is there's an interaction there.
There is, yes.
And you're talking about having that interactivity to a degree in a series, et cetera.
Probably not quite real time. But
well, no, but you'd have some feedback that
yes.
way.
Yes, and I think that's a good idea. I think that's part of what people are looking for now in their entertainment. They want to get involved. They want to have more to do with the shows that they like because people feel like they have friends in these shows. People, sadly, without lives, did look at the characters in Friends as their friends or looks at the characters in a show like Big Bang Theory as people that they might know and interact with, which, of course, they're not. They're characters, but...
Well, this isn't a new idea.
No.
You know? What was the movie Clue? Remember Clue had multiple endings and the audience voted for which one they wanted or something like that in the theater?
Yeah, it was still that tends to be gimmicky, I think.
Right, but yeah. I mean the concept was...
I'm thinking more in terms of, well, just are we going in the right direction? How did you respond to this new character? What's the likelihood of a story arc? I'm not sure how you fit that into the scheduling of production. But you need to have, I think... We need to build audiences and keep in touch with the audiences much more so than this currently happening.
Well, Snakes on a Plane did it.
Yeah, but that didn't really work for them. But then, of course, it wasn't... I understand it wasn't the world's best movie, so...
No.
But ultimately, you do have to deliver a product that people like.
Well, people were, you know, they were providing lines, and then some ended up in the movie, and they built an audience that, you know, they did actually have a bigger audience than they would have had
I didn't know,
without
I
all that.
Did not know about that preliminary part of it.
Oh, yeah. No, there's lines where, I don't know, Samuel Jackson says somebody's line that they submitted on the fan site, you know. So stuff like that happened, yep. And it built an actual audience for them. Now, yeah, the movie sucked, so it didn't go anywhere after that, but they had an audience the opening day.
Yeah.
You know, they already had, and they had a lot of PR already in the opening day because of that. It spread around. You know, like Paranormal Activity, the whole thing they did with that, you know, that was a movie that DreamWorks picked up. They bought it because the guy had done the movie. It was, you know, pretty low budget. They bought it. They were going to redo it. They were buying it for the rights. And Spielberg saw it and said, nah, we can release this movie ourselves. And so, you know, of course, they spent a fortune in sound mixing and post and all that. So it's really not as cheap as people try to make it sound like it was made. But what was clever is they went out and they four-walled theaters in five college towns and did midnight showings and let, you know, all the college students know. So they got these five showings, basically. The college students came to them and were like, oh, that's, you know, went back and they're all, you know, in their blog universe, right?
Yeah.
And then they put up a website and they said, if 1 million people – you know, sign our survey on this website, then we'll release the movie.
Yeah.
Well, it spread like crazy.
Then it was demand a screening in your town.
Yeah.
It was the next round. Yes.
Yeah, so it was a viral storm on the internet, so they had a pre-built audience when it came out.
And Kevin Smith, as you saw at Sundance, that Kevin Smith auctioned his movie, The Red State. He built this big, I'm going to auction it after the screening on the Sunday night of Sundance, and he got the auction started and sold it to himself, the distribution rights, for $20.
Because nobody else showed up?
No. This was... It peeved a number of the distributors that had turned up with an interest in purchasing the distribution rights. But then he used the time to go into a tirade about the whole distribution system and how it's failing the filmmaker. And
wow.
That when you get distribution, you don't make money, and which, of course, is the dirty secret, that you get distribution, but you rarely make a profit out of the distribution.
Right.
So he's going to, between now and when the film is released in October, he's going to take it on a roadshow and present it personally.
Right.
And expects to get back about half the budget of the movie from that and then put it into a broader distribution or more traditional distribution, but again, themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's, I think, about a $4 million movie, so it's not nothing.
Right. That's a lot to make back.
Well, it's a lot more than Clark's costume, that's for sure. Which remains the most profitable movie ever and based on investment. And return on investment, because they only spent $36,000 making the movie, and it returned multiple millions of dollars. But it's still a bigger budget.
Mm-hmm.
But he feels that he can get that back more directly rather than having to take it to a distributor who will then need to spend then another $20 million to promote this $4 million movie.
Mm-hmm.
That he, like I, think there's something kind of wrong to spend $20 million to promote a $4 million movie. And so he's going to see if he can do his thing and create a model for other people, because he's got one more movie coming and then he's going to devote his business time to distribution of movies independently, So I guess he's trying to build a new distribution model for himself and people like himself.
Yeah, but now instead of making product, which is what he's good at, he's going off and doing that. He should be using somebody else to do that and continue making movies.
And he would if he felt that he could find a fair deal.
Mm.
And he's been in this business long enough to know the reality that fair deals for independent filmmakers are rare. So he just figures he's got a better chance of doing it directly, as have a lot of other people. Mm-hmm. Tiffany Shane and a whole lot of other people, particularly in the documentary world, have done very well with taking it out and presenting it or talking about the subject of their movie, making income from not only the DVD sales, but also in sorts of ancillary stuff. And this is all part of the model that I think we need to look forward to is, you know, the guy that did a 1/6 right, Brian something unpronounceable, something that I can't remember, Tullinger or something, if I remember correctly, and I probably don't. And Brian, if you should ever hear this, I'm sorry. I'm going to give you lots of props for what else you did. So, because he not only sold DVDs of the movie, he sold the CD of the soundtrack, a calendar,
mm-hmm.
found their audience in pilot magazines, because who's the first audience? This is a very important concept in independent distribution. Your first audience, the one that's easy to get to because it's already interested
right.
in the subject.
Right.
Easier for documentary than entertainment, for sure. But this is the model. Find that first audience. Had, it's a couple of years back now, but Napoleon Dynamite.
Yeah.
Their first audience. They didn't have the budget to go out and do this big rollout. They didn't have the distribution.
So how'd they find the geek audience?
They found the geek audience because it's an easy one to find. You know where to advertise or promote for geeks as opposed to everybody. And it's easy to find a specific audience. Pilots, there are pilot magazines. There are geek-oriented magazines. I don't know what they are. I have no idea what magazines appeal to young geeks or what websites appeal to young geeks these days because I'm an old geek, not a young geek.
We wouldn't call you that, Philip.
Well, I'm closer to an old geek than a young geek. I see the calendar. I know what year it is.
You can still do that much math?
Yes. So I think that we could see a new model. I don't know that anyone's going to do this dramatic change. I don't know that anyone's got sort of $10 or $15 million to establish a greenfield production right from ground zero up.
Mm-hmm.
But it's theoretically possible. And maybe it is the way of the future. Maybe if Sharkey is right, Sharkey, about the way complex systems ultimately fail,
mm-hmm.
then the studios and networks that we're used to are those complex systems. And
yeah, no, I do think they're in trouble. Unless they manage to reinvent themselves downwards,
yes.
then, yeah, they will be. It can't continue business as usual, that's for sure. But I also...
But they will never. They will not be the ones that modify their own business because, generally speaking, the complex system cannot. It has to be ratted out. It has to be undermined by some new innovation or something new that replaces it. It's rare that the incumbent does.
But it
change.
Does happen. But it does happen.
Can you? I can't think of an example, but I'll concede that theoretically it can happen.
I'll come back at you with some because you know there's companies like Kimberly-Clark reinvented themselves. Walgreens reinvented themselves. You know. There are...
You're right, maybe individual companies have got a better chance.
That's what I'm saying. It can happen.
Sure.
But,
yeah.
I mean, you know, it's identifying, you know, some core tenants and going, you know, does this fit in our core tenant or not? And if it doesn't, having the balls to throw it out. That, I contend, is where the problem with the studios or any of these changing. I'll agree with you because the odds are nobody has the balls to do it. Oh, okay, here, Apple, perfect example. A computer company, right?
Yeah.
Are they a computer company anymore?
Well, they're not in the name.
No, because they had a leader who had the balls to go, you know, this is what we sell is not computers. What we sell is user experience. And I think my phone sucks, and I think I want to have a phone that works, so we're going to make a phone that works, just like we made a music device that works, et cetera, et cetera. They, you know, in most companies, if the, you know, CEO came and said, well, yeah, I know this is what we make now, but we should be making phones,
well,
he'd have been laughed out of the room. They wouldn't back him up. But because, A, you know, Jobs has this, you know, insane passion that everyone's afraid to buck, you know, so whatever he says, they're going to do. And B, he was right.
Yeah.
You know, had he been wrong, he'd be out of the business.
Yeah. And Apple have also the first to knife their own babies. I mean, who makes the better iPod every year? Who makes the iPod killer? Well,
right.
Apple make, in 2011, Apple will make the 2010 iPod killer.
Mm-hmm.
Because they want to do it first before somebody else does. And that sort of continuous innovation and continuous saying, how can we make our own thing better rather than simply milking it for as much profit?
So I contend that if you know, Warner Brothers, let's say, had a Steve Jobs running it, they would survive. They would not be doing in 5 years what they're doing right now, but they would be surviving and doing well, just like Apple is not doing what it was doing 5 years ago. It's a different company.
Very different company.
Right.
And a company that has enough money in the bank to replace the entire television production industry right now. You could make 800 movies or several thousand episodes of TV shows.
Mm-hmm. But that's not part of their model.
That's not part of their model. It's not the thing that they're doing. But no. I think it's a warning shot or something that the studios should keep over in mind when they are negotiating with Apple, that if ultimately they don't make the deal that Apple wants, Apple can go to the producers, David E. Kelly, and say, hey, we'd like a series. And you've got a budget of $1 million and we need 24 episodes and we're going to market exclusively through iTunes.
Well, I think that they're doing that but without having to put anything up, because they're building the pipeline that, you know, if you make a show, you put it through iTunes, you know, they make a little piece of it, they get it without putting anything out.
That's
it's
true.
All up to you.
But the
which brings us back to why I think the next version of Final Cut's going to have a big red button in the middle that says post to iTunes. But anyway,
not the next version, but but maybe not impossible in the long term. But if they're not happy with the deal, if they do want to do this streaming subscription service, which I'd frankly be interested in, and if the studios don't play along and say, we're not going to give you the premium content in the same sort of games that they're playing with Netflix now,
mm-hmm.
Apple, unlike Netflix, can simply say, well, screw you. We're just going to go to the same producers and ask them to produce something very like Big Bang Theory, very like Friday Night Lights, very like CSI. Will be ISC Las Vegas instead or something. There is no reason why, if the studios don't play ball, Apple or even Google couldn't just simply say, well, screw you guys, we're going to play our own game.
But I would contend that would not be a good idea, because it's not their business. You know what I mean?
So that's true.
You get diversified in an area that's not your core business and you're asking for trouble.
Payments is not their core business, but it looks like the next version or some future version of the iPhone will function as a payment device.
Yeah, but who's doing it?
Apple.
Yeah?
Apple.
So they're doing where you pay for something.
Yes, you go to Starbucks and you pay with your phone.
Oh, okay. Well,
through your Apple account.
But that is their business. Their business is making user interfaces easier.
That's true.
And profiting on it if they can. That's what I'm saying.
So.
That's their core business. I would contend that it's not making phones, it's not making computers, whatever you want to call it. It's user experience. That's what they sell.
So the only thing we've really agreed is that the future has to be different from today, and we've looked at one or a couple of ways it might be different and still have a chance of being something close to the industry that we know and love right now, where we can all make a living doing what we want to do, which is ultimately what it comes down to.
Yeah, so where have we got? We haven't gotten very far. So it sounds like Greenfield is several shows, because you're talking about, you know, there's the Greenfield of a studio, then there's the Greenfield of, well, what part of the studio? I mean, we really talk more about the production end now, whereas, you know, there's the distribution.
Marketing.
There's marketing.
I mean,
there are all kinds of.
Look at, as a small model, Revision 3, for example,
mm-hmm.
which is probably the closest of a model we have to this concept right now. It's a small production studio. It has a number of shows that are largely fairly sort of straightforward interview or talk show, news show. So we're not talking, at this point, really complex production.
Mm-hmm.
But they have managed to produce shows that have sufficient marketing behind them, sufficient advertising or promotional effort, not necessarily advertising, to make a profitable business and pay people. So we see some models there. Revision 3 is definitely starting down this path, and it's entirely plausible that they do Dignation, amongst other shows you may have heard.
Which one?
Dignation is their leading show. Like as I said, they're mostly talk and news-oriented.
Yeah, I haven't heard of them. Does that make me out of the loop?
A little. I think in summary, you can't just do one part of this. You've really got to make a commitment to producing in a more efficient manner, producing in a way that flattens out the hierarchy, leaves out a lot of the overhead that happens in a more traditional studio, that provides a good working environment for people, that researches and uses, I guess, social media of various kinds to determine where the audiences are before production is made, and then mm-hmm. make a show that fits that audience and keep in close contact with them to get a return from that audience, both by directly selling the show with advertising or brand sponsorship.
How's Revision 3 making?
Largely by advertising.
Because I'm looking on their site right now. I'm not seeing. Oh, I see an Amazon thing down in the corner.
But I think it's advertising in the shows themselves.
Oh, in the show. Okay.
Yeah, because that's what the product is. But I think, you know, product placement, I prefer to pure advertising. It's less intrusive on the show. And from a producer's point of view, I like it better, because if I'm integrating the brand into the show, it's going to be integrated in a harmonious way, or perhaps it's a bad fit.
Right. It's part of the story, so it doesn't take you out of the story.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. That sort of advertising promotion and ancillary products funded. Nice model is the hyper-distribution model from Mark Pesky. He's an American academic. He's responsible for some great technologies over the way. He's now in Australia at the Film, TV and Radio School and has a consultancy there. His concept of hyper-distribution is a single sponsor show. You build the you build the sponsorship brand into the show, and then you set it free. You send it on BitTorrent. You hope it's pirated everywhere because every person that downloads it and watches it is getting the product message as well as the show. And for the advertiser's point of view, it's one product message, not a lot. I don't know. This is not going to happen. I think I'm talking theory rather than a practical business plan that I could take to the bank and get funded tomorrow.
Right.
But I do think that all of what we've talked about is feasible, and it could create a lower cost structure. I'm not talking about $10,000 episodes of Big Bang Theory or something like that, but I'm talking about something that maybe, you know, we've gone from 3 million to 2 million an episode for an hour-long drama for the likes of Mad Men. Maybe we can go down to 1,750,000 and start to make the numbers work a whole lot easier.
I think it's safe to say that budgets are going nowhere but down anyways. That's all they've done for the entire time I've been.
Yeah, and we're talking about how do we keep the quality up when the budget goes down, and I don't know.
That's the hard part.
But I think we should wrap at this point because we're not going to get past that hard part this time. But you can keep budgets up with various ways, beat budget value, production value up in various ways that budgets don't necessarily show.
You're right. That's an entire another show.
In the meantime, if you want to see how you can reduce your workflow budget and do things more efficiently, head on over to assistedediting.com and check out the new version of Predit, which is now Adobe workflow free. You can still use the Adobe transcription tools, but if you've got regular old transcriptions, we will now use those to allow you to edit your paper cuts without the pain.
And if you have the need to capture from tape for your edit systems, or you need to output the tape, you can go to a digital service station near you. We're now international because we have a Canadian branch. Yes. Also, if you are looking to finish a show and you need to improve the quality, you need it to look better, you need it to sound better, you need the graphics done, you need the professional touch, look us up at Alpha Dogs. AlphaDogs.tv.
And don't forget to head over to theterrenceandphillipsshow.com and comment if you've got ideas to how to make this greenfields work. We'd love to hear it. Or if you've got an idea why it won't work, which I'm sure you'll find much easier, jump on over to the Terrence and Phillips Show and comment there. We'd love to get your feedback.
Thanks for listening.
Yep. Until next time, thanks for listening.